Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Hello. We're continuing our study in Genesis. Today we're going to begin a major theological event for really the rest of Genesis, beginning in chapter 37 through 50, with a couple of brief parentheses about Judah and Tamar and Jacob blessing the tribes, Genesis 49, is really an account of Joseph and how he prepares the way for the tribes to go into Egypt, and later on Exodus, how they come out. This forms a major, major truth in the Old Testament of God's gracious dealing with His people. And I think God's gracious dealing with His people can be seen in the life of Joseph. What a great figure Joseph is. Now, really, the history of Joseph is put under the rubric of Jacob's history. For the patriarch is Jacob. God never appears to Joseph as He does to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jacob is the major figure, but God working with Joseph is the means of preserving the tribes during famine. And the prophecy given to Abraham in chapter 15, verses 13 through 16, about their sojourning in a land is directly fulfilled as Joseph takes them down to Egypt to help them through the famine. Now, let's get your Bibles, if you would, and turn with me to Genesis 37. Now, verse 1 should really go with the previous chapter. For after a brief history of Ishmael's descendants and geographical locations, it gives the other side of the coin where Jacob lived. And the reason I say that is in verse 2, it says, "Now, these are the records of the generations of Jacob." That has been a key phrase in the book of Genesis that shows us how the author is dividing his book. For that repetitious phrase is used in the major divisions. And here they are. It's used in chapter 2, verse 4, chapter 5, verse 1, chapter 6, verse 9, chapter 10, verse 1, chapter 11, verse 10, and 27, chapter 25, verses 12 and 19, chapter 36, verse 1 and 9, and here in 37:2 is how the author of Genesis divides the major sections of his book. Now, Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, their father's wives. Now, this is significant for several things. It tells us the age of Joseph. That's going to be significant later on what price the Ishmaelite traders pay for him. It's also going to show his tender young age. And notice where it says, while he was still a youth. The Hebrew word here seems to imply an apprentice. It's used of Joshua as he served Moses in Exodus 33:17. And I think when it says the sons of Bilhah, now these are the two servants. Bilhah would be Rachel's servant, and Zilpah would have been Leah's servant. They, of course, had some children, two each. We learn that Bildad's children from chapter 30, verses 5 and 7, was Dan and Naphtali, and we learn that Zilpah's in chapter 30, verses 9 through 13, was Gad and Asher. Now, the reason they're probably mentioned together here is that they were all younger, and maybe they all were apprentices. They were shepherding, but they weren't completely in charge of a flock. They were still learning. There's a lot of interpretation here that goes on about, well, these are the only two, four sons that would really relate to Joseph because he was so arrogant. Now, as throughout Genesis, you can interpret the motivation of these people in different ways. I do not think that Joseph is a prideful, arrogant boy. I think he's a naive boy. Of all the people in the Bible that I know, nothing evil is said about. It's Joseph and Jesus. And there's a lot of typology, as there was between Isaac and the offering of Isaac on Mount Moriah. And a lot of typology between Joseph and Jesus. Now, if I told you before, I personally am a little nervous of typology because of how it's been abused so badly in the history of the church. Personally, I do not make a big deal on typology unless the New Testament authors show us where it is. And so I'm a little nervous about making Joseph a type at every point, but I think it's obvious that he is. Now, notice where it mentions them. Let's see. And Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father. We're going to see the growing tension between Joseph and these other sons of Jacob. First of all, this bad report he brought back. Now, the rabbis have an extensive list that they were eating the flesh off wild animals and carousing around and on. All of that is supposition. We don't know what the bad report involved. but it certainly didn't endear Joseph to his brothers. And then when you combine that with the idea that Joseph gave him a special coat, showed favoritism toward him, and combined with that, Joseph's dreams that seemed to show his preeminence over the others, you got a bad situation. You think Jacob would have learned something about favoritism from growing up in Isaac's house, but he didn't. Now, notice what mentions them in verse 3. Now, Israel. Now, of course, earlier Jacob, as he wrestled with the angel at the brook Jabbok, his name was changed from trickster to Israel. And there's a lot of question about what the precise etymology of the word Israel is, fruitful of God or whatever. So here's the name. He's called Israel here. He loved Joseph more than all his other sons because he was the son of his old age. Now, there's two possibilities here. He was the son of Rachel, his favorite wife, we learn from chapter 30, verses 22 through 24. He wasn't all that much younger than the other boys. Matter of fact, Benjamin, the son that Rachel died having, is much younger than Joseph. Maybe it was a title for Joseph, but just stuck. We're not real sure. Now, the rabbis say, particularly the Targums, that this son of old age really means having wisdom of advanced age. But that is terribly inappropriate. It just means he liked the boy, probably because he was Rachel's son. Now, it said he made him. It's a perfect tense in Hebrew, which seems to imply as the boy grew, as he wore out one special tunic, his father made him another of the same kind. That's the idea here. A very colored tunic. Now, I want to talk about that a minute. First of all, a tunic was an undergarment sometimes. It had short sleeves. It was about to the waist. It was designed so you could work in it. But this tunic has two possible derivations, and we're not sure which it really is. One could mean multicolored, and there are some examples, some historical precedents in the same historic period from the pictures we found in the tombs in Egypt. Not Hebrews, but Jebusites, which, of course, is a Canaanite tribe. The other possible derivation means from the palms to the soles. In other words, a long sleeve, not multicolored, but long sleeve to the palms and down to the ankles. Now, that we've learned from other references in the New Testament, particularly the 1 Samuel, I believe it's 2 Samuel 13:18, where Tamar is raped by one of her brothers, that she had a special kind of robe on that the virgin daughters of the king wore. Now, that's the same term used here. So it has the implication of beauty and royalty. It's obvious it showed the favoritism of the father. Joseph was the only one that had it, and Joseph wasn't able to do manual labor dressed in this. Many have asserted that since Reuben went into one of his father's concubines back in Genesis 35:22, and was therefore undeserving of the right of the patriarchal blessing, that Jacob kind of assumed that Joseph would get it and gave him this cloak. Now, that's possible, and it explains the reason why Jacob listened to the dreams that Joseph had. He stored them in his heart. Maybe he was looking for God's answer. But isn't it unusual that this last great heroic figure is not the one that got the line of the Messiah and the patriarchal blessing? That's going to be Judah, which is one of the sons of Leah. Now, let me go back now. By the way, Rashi thinks it means full length. King James and Luther thinks it means varied colored. By the way, you think this special tunic rubbed salt in the wounds on his brother's jealousy? You know it. And his brothers saw their father loved him more than all his brothers, and so they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. Oh, my. Yet God's going to deliver him. And Joseph had a dream. Now, we've learned from Genesis that dreams were often the way God communicated to the patriarchs. It doesn't specifically say God did this, but the dream seems to have fulfillments later on in Joseph's life in Egypt. So he had a dream, and he's going to tell it to his brothers. And, oh boy, I think this is pretty naive on his part, and wasn't thinking through this real well because it caused a lot more tensions. It's about the sheaves in a field. When you bind them, you lay them down. But Joseph saw his raise up and stay up, and the other sheaves come and bow down to the other 11. Now, this was fulfilled later on. If you look at verse 7, you might want to put out to the side that it was fulfilled in Genesis 42:6, Genesis 43:26, and Genesis 44:14 is exactly where this was fulfilled. Matter of fact, the coat that Jacob gave him had the implication of this already. Now, notice what it says. Then his brothers said to him, "Are you actually going to reign over us? Are you really going to rule over us?" It's irony, isn't it? Prophecy. So they hated him even more for his dreams. Now, he had another dream, and this dream he told to his father. By the way, I've just forgotten, so I saw my notes, and I want to go back just for a minute and mention to you that this varied-colored tunic, the rabbis make such a wild kind of interpretation on this, I wanted to share it to you briefly. The Hebrew letters for the word tunic are P-S-Y-M. They make an acrostic of that for sold by Potiphar, which is the P, sold by the merchant, which in Hebrew starts with the S, sold by the Ishmaelites, which in Hebrew would start with the Yod or the Y, and then sold to the Midianites, which would be the final M. This is just one of the examples of the hermeneutical principles, first by Hillel 7, then developed into Ishmael's 13, and then finally into Eliezer's 32. And this midrash, you could almost make the Bible say anything. Here they make an acrostic. Excuse me, I wanted to go back. I thought it was kind of cute. Now, back at, then in verse 9, he tells another dream to his father Jacob. Notice in verse 10. And Jacob's going to rebuke him. This word rebuke is a very strong Hebrew term. Matter of fact, this is the word rebuke that's used in Jeremiah 29:27. We see it in God's rebuke of the nations, Isaiah 17:13. We see it in Zechariah 3:2 for the angel's rebuke of Satan. So Jacob really does put the bite on Joseph for his arrogance here, maybe for his naivety. He mentions his mother. Now, his mother, Rachel, died back in chapter 35:19. Some say that Bildad, her slave, took over the raising of Joseph, and that's probably very true. Verse 11, and his brothers were jealous of him because his father kept this saying in his mind. I think Jacob must have remembered back to God's revelation to Rebekah back in 25:23 that he was God's choice. And maybe he was looking for Joseph to be God's choice. This is almost like Mary who stored these things in her hearts about Jesus. Jacob's going to remember this dream. He thinks there might be something to it, although he rebukes the boy for saying it publicly. Now, notice it says, then his brothers went to pasture their father's flock in Shechem. Now, Shechem, if you remember, is a site where they killed all the male of that city. But maybe time has passed. Jacob bought some land there. Maybe they're using that. But anyway, it becomes a very important religious site later on. It's the site when they enter the promised land that Joshua will have the covenant renewal with the Levitical singers on Mount Ebal and Mount Gezerim, in which Shechem is in the valley. Very important site. So his father's going to send them to his brothers to check on them. Now, either for two reasons. To try to get Joseph to be a part of the brothers, or it seems that Joseph was always telling his father what the brothers were doing. And that's what it says. He sent his Joseph to find out how the brothers were doing, how the flocks were doing, and to bring back a report in verse 14. That's very similar to verse 2. Verse 15, then a man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. Isn't this unusual? You'd recall Joseph wandering around and an unnamed man founds him. I was interested when I was reading Rashi that he says it's the angel Gabriel, the man of God. I think that's a bit much. What we can say here is it shows God's providence that God wanted Joseph to be sold into slavery. And God's involved behind all that's happening here. And this is just one of the incidental accounts that seems so haphazard. And yet, my friends, I want you to know that our lives aren't controlled by fate or chance or luck or the whims of men. If we're a child of God, our lives are in the hands of God, and that which seems evil, even evil to our understanding, God will work it out for good. Hallelujah. So here we have an unnamed man says, I heard them, and they were talking about going to Dothan. Now, it's interesting. If you follow on the map, the route here, from Jacob staying around Hebron, and the boys first going to Shechem, and then north about 26 miles to Dothan, you get the idea, if you see a map that has the historical roads on it, that this is a major trade route that they were following. That's going to be significant, because they're going to sell into some traders who were using this trade route. Now, we mentioned Dothan. Dothan's an interesting town. It literally means two wells. Later on, in 2 Kings 6, it's the site where Elisha has the servant's eyes open, and he sees the chariots of fire all around Elisha. So it's a town that the miracles of God were there more and more. Now, notice in verse 18, and then they saw him from a distance. Now, they probably recognize his cloak, don't you think? His tunic. And before he came close, they plotted against him to put him to death. Oh, my. The sin of Cain against Abel. The proposed sin of Esau against Jacob. And now this killing of brothers is still in the human race. God help us. It's in our hearts today, isn't it? And they said to one another, here comes the dreamer. Now then, come, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. The area must have had a lot of cisterns, still does. And we will say a wild beast devoured him. Then let us see what will become of his dreams. Now, it seems to me they were trying to, maybe in a subconscious way, protect their own inheritance rights. If Joseph really was the promised one, which Jacob thought he was by the tunic, and apparently they thought God did by the dreams, here they're trying to thwart God's will by killing the heir. It almost reminds you of one of Jesus' parables, doesn't it? Well, that's what they're going to do. But Reuben, now Reuben's the firstborn. In verse 21 down through 24, we talk about Reuben, and in verse 26 and 27, we're going to talk about Judah. We don't really know the boys' true motives, although they're going to speak one way. We don't know what they were thinking. Reuben seems to want to rescue the boy. This may have been because he firstborn son and would have been responsible to his dad. It may have been he was in hot water based on going into his dad's concubine that his dad found out about back in Genesis 35:22 and thought this might reinstate him. But whatever the reasons, look at the end of verse 22. He says that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father. That seems to be his real purpose. And if you look at verse 29, he tried to do that. Now, but the other boys, they didn't kill him, but they took him and threw him in a pit. Now, it's interesting if you compare this with Genesis 42:21, you hear the crying and pleading of Joseph. Oh, please, brothers, don't do this to me. Oh, please. He pled with them. And these hard-hearted old devils, as soon as they threw him in the pit, in verse 25, they had dinner. Didn't even bother them a lick. They just threw the boy with all his crying in the pit, and they sit down and have dinner. Callous suckers, aren't they? I tell you what. The cistern didn't have any water in it, which says the pit was a cistern. Maybe a natural one, maybe a hewn out one. We're just not sure. Then they sat down and ate a meal. And as they raised their eyes and looked, a caravan of Ishmaelites. There's been this chapter has been the epitome of the JEDP's theory of source criticism. They see in this several different accounts. Now, because it says Ishmaelites here in verse 25, but down in verse 28 it says Midianites, and then again in verse 28 it reverts back to Ishmaelites, and then down in verse 26 it really says Midianites, not Midian, but Midianites, who we learn are brothers from Genesis 25:2. They're both sons of Abraham through Keturah. And they say, see, all these different names means different sources. I don't think that's true. It's either variety or this caravan was made up of several different racial groups or family groups. I think the JEDP theory of source criticism is really the pits. A good book, if you want to know more about this, would be Josh McDowell's Evidence That Demands a Verdict, Volume 2. And I think it kicks it in the head pretty well. And God knows it needs to be kicked in the head. Now, here are these Ishmaelites. And by the way, the Ishmaelites and the Midianites are identified as one group in Judges 8:24, because they both wear gold earrings. Sounds like my own city in my own day, where the guys started wearing earrings again. Well, anyway, they're bringing spices and all kinds of things from India and Mesopotamia and Gilead that was known for its bombs. Now, this was very important to Egypt for several reasons. Number one, they embalmed with these spices and bombs. And secondly, it was used for incense in temples and in houses. And thirdly, this was some of the ingredients of the ancient medicine and the remedies of which the Egyptians are very famous for in their literature. They developed brain surgery 2000 B.C. and used many of these herbs and natural things for medicines. Now, notice it says then in verse 26, then Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Now, Judah may have had an ulterior motive of trying to save his brother and just tried to reason with his other brothers the way Reuben had done. Let's give him the benefit of the doubt. But anyway, the two motives that are expressed here is let's sell him and get something out of it. And number two, he is our brother, right? So Judah does say that. But here come the Midianite traders. They're going to sell him to them. They're going to sell him for 20 shekels of silver. Now, that's the shekels, as you know, is in italics in the New American Bible, which means it's not in the Hebrew. It just means to weigh out some silver. Now, we find from Leviticus 27:5 that later this was the price of a young male slave. Now, a mature male slave brought 30 shekels of silver, as we learned from Exodus 21:32, and you might want to compare those. And they brought them down into Egypt. It's ironical to me, if you look back at your map for a minute, that caravan route came right back by close to Joseph's home. Jacob, his father, wasn't many, many miles away, probably less than a mile away from where these traders went right through, but either Joseph was tied up, or bound or gagged or something, and it wasn't in God's will that his father find him. He went on down to Egypt. Now in verse 29. Now Reuben returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit, so he tore his garments. Now this is one of the signs of mourning that's so common in the Bible. There are several not mentioned here, but several are. I want you to notice then in verse 34, when Joseph's apparent death is told to Jacob, look what Jacob does. He tears his clothes, just like Reuben did. He puts sackcloth on his loins, and he mourned. Now, some of the other mourning rites that aren't mentioned here is the plucking out of the beard, the shaving of the head, the sitting on the floor, the putting dust and ashes on the head. These are other signs of mourning. Now, when it says rent the garment, the Jews in this period wore an outer garment to sleep in and an inner garment. They tore the outer garment, the neck, about 3 inches. If it was a woman, she turned it backwards for modesty. And that's the ideal here. Now, he returned to his brothers and said, the boy is not there. Now, he was surprised, and his brothers, he learned very quickly, they had already done something with him. It's funny to me that Reuben falls in with the plot, the lie. I guess they all stuck together here because they were trapped in this lie, but they did. So they're going to kill a goat and dip that multicolored or long sleeve, whichever it is, tunic in there. And they're going to take it to their dad and say a wild animal killed him. Now, whether they cut the garment like wild animal claws or left it whole, we just don't know. But they're going to take it to Jacob. They didn't take it, by the way. They sent somebody with it. And they sent the very colored or long-sleeved tunic and brought it to their father and said, we found this. Please examine to see whether it is your son's tunic or not. Didn't even mention Joseph's name. Of course, they knew what happened. It was his tunic. Only one of them had it. And now he examined it, and it was his son's tunic. A wild beast had devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces. So Jacob enters this period of mourning. It lasted a long time. Then all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him. Isn't that irony? The very ones who sold him now try to comfort their dad. Now these daughters have been interpreted in two ways. We know of one daughter, Diana. Whether Jacob had others that weren't listed, we're just not sure. Most commentators say it's the daughter-in-laws, the wives of the sons, and that would fit also. But he refused to be comforted. He said, surely I will go down to Sheol in mourning for my son. I think it's important that we look at this word Sheol for a minute. I think Sheol, which has two possible derivations. Let me find them real quickly here in my notes. Okay. They both spell the same way. We're just not sure of the original etymology. One group of commentators says it means to go down or to sink down into the earth. The other says it means to ask of or inquire. And the sense here is Sheol asks or requires all men. Its appetite's never full. It just wants more and more humans. The other is that humans ask a lot of questions about Sheol, the afterlife. Now, it seems in the Old Testament there is a series of progressive revelations concerning the afterlife. Originally, it was a shadowy existence where the righteous and the unrighteous went. Later on, rabbinical theology, it was separated into Paradise and Tartarus. The Gentiles were on one side, of course, and the Jews on the other as they saw it. And again, I think we have to say that the New Testament term Hades is synonymous with Sheol. It's often translated the pit, the grave, the holding place of the dead, the underworld, and I think that's what it is. I've done a tape where I have done a word study on these four major words of places of the afterlife. Sheol, Hades, Gehenna, and Tartarus. If you'll send for our free catalogs of almost 3,000 tapes, we'll provide that catalog to you free, and you might enjoy the word study there. I really think that it was split, that in Jesus' day, remember when he died on the cross and he told the thief, today you'll be with me in paradise? Jesus did not go back to heaven for 40 days, so I think paradise there does refer to the righteous side of Hades or Sheol. We learn from Luke 16 that the wicked side, there was punishment and torment. My personal belief is that when Jesus resurrected from the dead, he took the righteous side with him. Now, 1 Corinthians 5:8 says to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. So we do not go to Sheol when we die as believers, but we go to the presence of the Lord. There's a lot of complications there. We can't be certain. William Hendrickson's book on questions on the life hereafter is a good reference book in this area, too. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar. Now, Potiphar is an Egyptian name that seems to mean he to whom is given. and the to whom refers to the sun god Ra. Okay? Now it says he's Pharaoh's office, the word eunuch, which means a castrated one, but since he has a wife, we see this term can mean just a courtier. Now it calls him the captain of the bodyguard. Now this is interesting, for the idea of bodyguard is literally the chief slaughterer. And it can be used of a cook. You might want to see, let's see where it's used of a cook here. Okay? I believe if you look at Genesis 43:16 and compare that with 1 Samuel 9:23 and 24, you'll see it in the sense of cook. But if you look in the Genesis account of chapter 40:3 and compare that with 2 Kings 25:8, it simply means captain of the bodyguard, a very important official next to the ruler. And I think that's going to fit the biblical text better than the chief cook. So the slaughterer here means the bodyguard instead of the butcher. And we're going to get into Potiphar next week. I want to say again that we see the hand of God here so clearly, although it's not as specific as it was a patriarch. Joseph is a tremendously wonderful character, but God is working in his life behind the scenes, not in the miraculous way and the direct revelatory way he has in Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It's interesting to me that though nothing evil is said about Joseph, the line of the Messiah and the patriarchal promise and covenant don't go through him, but go through Judah. I think here we have a beautiful example of providence. And I want to say to you, I don't know what you're going through, but all of us have problems in our lives. All of us go through times of uncertainty, things we can't understand. But this chapter is unique in the fact that God has a plan. He has a plan not only overarching for the redemption of man, but God cares for individuals. We've seen that so clearly as the angel of the Lord came to Hagar. We see it here as God, though it looks so evil, use this experience, this young teenage boy, for the salvation and deliverance of the entire nation. My friend, don't give up. God is involved in your life. God does have a plan. God can use you and will use you if you just trust Him and yield yourself to Him. Take the long look. Don't get tunnel vision. Don't get bitter. It will work out all right. God is in control. He does love us so. I've enjoyed being with you. I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. May the Lord be with you.